A slowly recovering Al-Anon. My name is Rick Chatuk. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi, Rick.
And as they say in the land of our taper, by the grace of God, the power of a program called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, a fellowship called the Al-Anon Family Group, and the loving but very firm guidance of a big book, Black Belt Al-Anon sponsor, it's not been necessary for me to plan any kind of death, yours or mine, since the 10th day of April, 1987, and for that, I am grateful. My hometown is Toronto, Canada. My home group is the St. Clair Al-Anon Family Group. We meet every Tuesday night in the Holy Spirit Catholic Church on St. Clair Avenue between Bathurst and Spadina. If you're ever in Toronto on a Tuesday night, I'd like to come to a really great Al-Anon meeting. We'd love to have you join us. I want to thank Carolyn for the invitation. Nice to be here. And, you know, these things are great. I hope that I never get used to or unexcited when these invitations come, either in person or kind of on the machine. It's kind of cool. You come home and there's a little invite in a machine asking you to come somewhere. And I always get this little thrill, and then my mind goes to think, well, let's kind of take a look at this. They're asking me to come to wherever, in this case, Canada Degua. to talk about my favorite topic, me. And they're going to give me a really lovely room. This is a fantastic facility. They're going to give me some meals. I'm going to pay for all my expenses. I'm going to get to meet some great people, and AA is going to pay for all of it. I love that. There is definitely vindication, ladies. Stick around long enough. Actually, do you call this Northern New York or Northwestern New York? Or I don't know what you call this area, but I kind of added it up. I've actually been in this area 7 times speaking before, and kind of thought, I wonder if Carolyn knew that, and she probably not. I tend to think that, you know, everybody remembers, but really they just forget. And I've had people even call me from the same conference and say, well, hey, would you like to come? And say, well, you know, I've been there before. And they go, really? I'm thinking, well, gee, I thought that was a pretty good talk. One time, keeps me humble. One time I'm standing in line to thank a speaker at a conference at home, and I was with a woman that I know, and just kind of chat with her, and she said, well, gee, I just came back from the conference in Akron. I said, Akron, gee, that's the Founders Day conference. She said, yeah, it was really great. She said, I was standing in line to buy a tape, and I saw a tape of yours. And so my mind goes, whoosh. Well, how about that? Gosh, I've never been to Akron, but they're selling a tape of mine there. How about that? And then her next sentence is, yeah, it was in a bin labeled, any tape, $1. So at least I made it to the used tape bin at Akron. There you go. So it really is not about Rick from Toronto. It really is about some kind of message that I hope I can share here. I've come across many times, and I did get detained at the border yesterday. And they pulled me into your immigration, and I was sitting there waiting, thinking, gosh, I've never been arrested. So the woman calls me up and she says, What are you doing going to the Canada Degua? And mercifully, I had a program that Carolina had sent me. That was a really handy thing. So I showed her the program and the handwritten letter and all kinds of stuff, and the woman goes through it. And then she looks at me and she says, well, just what do you do when you go there? And so I had this kind of little thought. This is an opportunity for cooperating with the professional community. So I says to her, I said, well, it's in a conference put on by Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I'm not an alcoholic, but I am an Al-Anon. Al-Anon is a program for the family and friends of alcoholics. We use the same 12 steps that AA uses to help us overcome the effects of alcoholism, the family disease. And she looks at me. Your customs officials and immigration officials don't have a particularly keen sense of humor. But I thought that went pretty well, and she just kind of said, I'll be back in a minute, and walked and talked to somebody and came back and said, you're okay, and stamped the thing and let me through. And then she typed something in, so maybe that's what's in there. He's Brian Allen on, coming across to do this thing, but I am really, really, really glad to be here. It's great to see Billy Sue, my sister in sponsorship, her husband Pat. I certainly enjoyed our speaker last night. As you can tell, not everybody from Canada speaks like that. And I really enjoyed... really enjoyed Joellen this afternoon and being on the invited to speak on that, or sit in on the panel with the other speakers this morning. Was really, really quite nice. So thank you. It's a really lovely thing that you do. In Elon, we have this tradition that says the only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or a friend, which means that I must qualify. Because as we all know, anybody can join AA. We have to know someone to get into Al-Anon. And I've known five major ones, all kinds of peripheral ones, but five major ones, a father, grandmother, two of them by birth, and more importantly to the story that I need to share with you today, three by choice. And two of those three that I chose, I met in Al-Anon, ladies. I just kind of have this unwavering attraction to female alcoholics. And so what I'd just like to say to you, based on my own experience, is that if you are here this afternoon and you're female and you are in Al-Anon, and you're wondering if you have a problem with alcohol, ignore any kind of question that anybody will present to you from Alcoholics Anonymous. At the end of this meeting, simply come up and say to me, "Do you find me attractive?" And if the answer is yes, run like hell to AA. You're in the wrong room. If I think you're cute, you're in the wrong place. We've lost a lot of good members to AA, I'll tell you that. Is that not the most beautiful music you can hear? Us laughing. How long did we cry? How long did we wallow in that pain? How long did we sink into that depression? How long did we think, "I'm the only one"? And here we gather together at these incredible get-togethers like this one, and we can laugh and joke and giggle about those things that we were afraid not only to utter to another human being, but to allow into our own consciousness. What a gift, what a blessing that is. I love the sound of our laughter. And I love what accompanies our laughter. We always go like this. I love what happens when we share at our meetings. We see people going, I love that approval. That's not approval. I love approval. You'll hear that in a minute. But I just kind of love that sense of identification, the power that Bill and Bob found when one met the other. And they just kind of said, "Yeah, I understand. I understand what it's like to have gone through that. It's so beautiful. And I still, to this day, after all these years, need to have that in my life." I have absolutely no memory of a time before alcoholism. There's never a magic moment where somebody said, "Hey, Rick, your grandmother's an alcoholic, all these Scottish relatives are alcoholic, your father's alcoholic." It just kind of never came, there's never a time that I could remember that being said to me. It's just something that I have always known. It's omnipresent in my life. Every time I've looked at the end of my arm, there's been a hand. And every time I've looked at the bottom of my leg, there's been a foot. And that is how present alcoholism is in my life. And I want to tell you right from the get-go that the alcoholism in other people is not why I am standing here today. That is not my problem. That is their problem. I have a problem that's similar to it. It's called alcoholism - the family disease. And that's why the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous work for an alcohol abuser like me. I am one of those people that all the alcoholics joke about who loves to have half a bottle of beer, put the cap back on, and put it in the fridge. I like to do that. I like thinking, I really drink it all, but that's the way that is for me. Alcohol, the substance, has never done it for me. A female alcoholic, every time. Yes! Watching Joellen on TV, I was in another room and thinking, she's really attractive. I go, "Ah!" Did this ever go away? But no memory. It's just kind of always been there. And as a young kid, I was really just a frightened little guy. I spent a lot of time in the bathroom. I peed all the time. I threw up all the time. It was just a way to relieve the pressure. I did a lot of crazy things. One of the things I did as a young child is I would frequently clean out all of the clothes out of my closet, empty it out, really, and I'd move in a little table and a little chair, and I'd hang a light over the bar that holds the clothes, and go in there with some paper and something to write with, and the first thing I'd always write was, "Keep out!" And I'd put this sign up on the outside of the closet door, and then I would go into the closet and close the door, and kind of sit in there and wonder why nobody would come in. Or I would build a little enclosure in my basement to protect myself. And again, once again, I would do that on a piece of paper. I would write, "Keep out!" And I'd paste it on the outside of this fortification. And once again, go inside and wonder why nobody would come in. And as a metaphor for my life as I grew up, that is a very good one. Because in my yearning inside always was, "I wish you would come in." But the external of me was so frightened of you that I would push you away in many, many ways, with my words, with my eyes, with my kind of absence of spirit when I was talking with you. I am kind of one of those people who can be present with you and be totally gone, that my physical form will be with you, but my spirit has disappeared. And that is a constant, ongoing challenge of my life, to deal with those kind of things. And that certainly is the way I grew up. And only working these 12 steps in conjunction with a loving sponsor, a tough one, but a real loving sponsor, has helped me begin to overcome that aspect of my life, and people have started to come in, and I'm really, really grateful for that. I would do other things like hang around with those who are younger than me just so that I could feel like I belonged. When I was in grade school, if I was in grade 4, I'd go over to the area where the younger kids were in kindergarten, and they'd think I was so big and great, and for a moment in time, I could feel like I was okay. When I was in high school, I was in grade 11, and I took a history course in grade 9, and one of the activities in this grade 9 history class was to, exploring the political system in Canada, and so we kind of elected a parliament, and so I got elected the prime minister, because I was in grade 11, and there's a part of me that said, that whole thing of never feeling equal with those I was with, and always needing to feel like I was above them or older than, just so that for a brief moment in time, I could feel that I was okay. I loved attention. I didn't want really positive attention. I just kind of wanted people to know that I was around, and so I became a vandal. I did all kinds of young vandalism things. I loved to set fires to things. And really did become a pyromaniac, and one day I'd set fire to a field at lunchtime and went back to school, and fire engines came running down the street to put out this field, and there was a sense inside me of, ha, 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 ha. I knew, and everybody kind of knew, but nobody could really pin it on me. I set a mailbox on fire one time and just enjoyed standing watching it on fire. And the following morning, as I was walking to school, the postman was cleaning out these burnt-up mailbags, and I said, "Gee, what happened?" He said, "Somebody set this on fire." I said, "Boy, they should catch that guy," and kind of walk away. And nobody was telling me to do anything like that. It just started to develop. I love to walk into a room. I did this personality test when I was in high school. And after I did it, the result came back, and my personality was described as amorphic. I didn't know what that meant. I asked the person, "What does amorphic mean?" And they said, "It means you shape yourself to whatever situation you're in." And I said, "Well, hey, that's pretty good. It means I'm pretty flexible." They said, "Rick, no, it does not mean that. It is not a good thing. It means that you don't know who you are, and that you kind of become whatever you need to be so you can fit for a brief moment of time into the situation that you are in." And these are some of the things that I did, not because there was alcoholism in my home, but because there was a disease called alcoholism, the family disease, in me. That the people around me were alcoholics, and there's a disease in place there that we were affected by and then became inflicted with. My mother became nervous. Her young kid was doing all these crazy things, so she took me to the doctor, and they gave me all kinds of tests, and all the tests came back negative. And they said, "Mrs. Jatuk, there's nothing wrong with your son." But if they had a disease for what was wrong with me, if they had a test for the disease that I had, for what was wrong with me, a test that could show you that you have a disease called alcoholism, the family disease, mine would have come back glaringly positive, because that is what was wrong with me. There was alcoholism in the home, and I was just growing up in the midst of this. My dad drank. Dad drank a lot. My dad loved to do a few things, and I'm not going to tell you his story, but I'll just kind of tell you one little aspect of it. My dad loved to do three things. My father loved to drink, he loved to garden, and he loved to take his clothes off. A little embarrassing. And so he'd start on a day like today, a beautiful spring day or early summer day. He would start in the backyard of our suburban home, and he'd get all his garden tools out there, and he'd start basically dressed and start drinking beer. And as he worked his way to the front of the house, the day got hotter, and the beer took its effect. And by the time he was midday, he was in the front of the house. doing the gardening. And by then, he wasn't really totally naked, but he had turned a pair of Bermuda shorts into a thong. And my father loved to drink beer, and so he had that beautiful beer belly. And it was around the time when nobody really cared about the sun causing cancer to your skin, so to oil himself up. And there he was out there, and people kind of looking at him. And I can just see my mother looking out the front window at this once, you know, once knight in shining armor of hers, saying, "You get in here now, you hunk, I want you right now." He said, "Don't we go to those places? Alcoholism just kind of brings us all over the place." But then my father had an anger problem, and there's a guy in our street who used to run motorcycles and cars up and down the street, and one day my dad went after him in the thong, oiled up. Caught him, and all the neighbors were gathering around, and it's like, oh, what a scene. And there it is, one of the symptoms of alcoholism, the family disease. See, my dad is out there showing his ass. We're afraid to show our face. He's out there doing that. We're embarrassed. We're not doing anything. We're kind of inside. But he's doing that. We are ashamed. He shows his ass. We can't show our face. Isn't that one of the symptoms of what we, the family members of alcoholics, suffer from? They are not doing that to us. The alcoholic is just doing what an alcoholic does. They drink, period. They're not drinking at me. They're not drinking at the family. They're just doing it. And then the disease is in there, and we are affected by a disease. And we, in my family, were affected by a disease. Years later, I'm happy to tell you, my dad got sober. That was a great thing. And he put the bumper stickers on the back of the car. Easy does it, let go and let God. My mother says to my father, "For God's sake, Donald, why do you have those bumper stickers on the back of the car? Everybody's going to see them." I said, "Mom, they've seen everything else." But isn't that yet another symptom of what we, the family members of alcoholics, do? We don't want them to know when there's drinking going on. Sobriety's in there. We don't want them to know that either. They've seen it all. Every once in a while, people would wake up on our street and the contents of our home were on the front lawn. And we were not moving. Two bumper stickers. Ah! They're going to know! And there we are. Eh? We live in this delusion denial. Hey, nobody knows, nobody knows, nobody knows. Don't let anybody know, don't let anybody know. Because we're so ashamed. Nobody's telling us to do that. That's what alcoholism, the family disease, begins to do to people in a family, children and spouses alike. Sometimes even the pets. So my mom, when she shares her story, says, as soon as my dad would come in, the cat would disappear. He knew. We didn't disappear. We got right in his face. Yeah! The cat was gone. We didn't know any better. A wonderful thing happened to me when I was 11 years old. Into this active alcoholic home, my mother, who had joined Al-Anon not too long ago, invited. There was an Al-Anon conference happening in Toronto. And they had put out a request through the Al-Anon meetings to people to just billet the Al-Anon members that were coming. So my mom knew she had this wonky kid at home, me. And she said, "Okay, I'll take four." So into this active place, she brought these four Al-Anon members, and I was 11 years old. It was 1968. And a marvelous thing happened to me. I did not come to you. You people came to me. These smiling faces, these nodding heads, the fellowship walked in through my front door. And I felt something in my young life at that time that I had never really felt. I just felt like it was okay to be with these people. It was that simple, and it was that profound. And we know how profound that is, that when we are finally with those who understand, there is a power that is so wonderful and so beautiful and that can and will help us if we take 12 simple steps to get to it. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And from there, I started going to Al-Anon when I was 11 years old and into 12. They told me some great things. When I got there, they said, "Rick, your father is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man." Listen to that. Your father is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. Said, "Rick, your father has a disease. He is not a disgrace." Rick, they said, "Your father is not drinking at you. You are not doing anything that causes this drinking. He is an alcoholic, and that's what alcoholics do." And I so needed to hear that, and that was so helpful to me to know that those things were true. Because I came to see, because my dad did not drink all the time. There were times when he was an absolutely amazing guy, a loving, caring, kind, humorous father. And then there were times when the disease hit. And I don't believe for a second that there was ever a single morning in my father's life where he woke up and said, "I'm going to go out tonight and get rip-roaring drunk and come home and terrorize my family." But that happened on a regular basis. But I don't believe there was a second when he ever thought to do that. But I do believe that he said, I'm going to go out tonight and I'm going to have a few beers. And then a disease took over. And the disease just played itself out. And I'm so happy to know that it's the disease that did that. That there was no purposeful intent in any of those things that went on in that home. And that even all these years later, as my father, because my father is still active, he stopped and he started again, that I know that my father has a disease. He is not a disgrace. That he's an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. I had lunch with him on Wednesday. It was delightful. It is my job to show up and be the very best son I can be to that man and not allow his disease to push me away or to determine how I am going to be with him. I am so grateful for that. I stayed in Alateen until I was 21. They kicked me out. It's the only place in any of our fellowships where you get kicked out of. They say, Rick, you can't be 21, bald, and have a beard and stay in Alateen. I don't want to go! They said, you got to go! And so I left, and I'd had a lot of great experiences when I was Alateen, and it helped me a lot of great fellowship stuff. And so I went, and I found myself an Al-Anon group, kind of a harem, really. I had these dozen women in a church basement, you know, and they were lovely, and they kind of knew who I was, and I just kind of enjoyed that. And every once in a while, another guy had come to the meeting. And I'd stand up, and my hand would go up and say, welcome, and my eyes would say, get the hell out of here. Go find your own harem. No sickness here, baby. Happens even when you're in there. And I hung around there for about 5 years, and then it was done, because I met my real higher power then, and her name was Susan. And she was so exciting. She was more exciting than anybody up to that point that I ever met in these rooms. And that's really what I would like to talk to you about today. Just what it is. Just what are the choices that I make. Am I who I am because of alcoholics? Or do I choose alcoholics because of who I am? I've been affected by a disease, but I've made the choice 3 times. And at the end of the 3rd one, it was crystal clear to me that this is not, N-O-T, not about them. I'm the one doing this. Nobody's telling me to do this. I'm doing it. Just for interest's sake, how many people here have chosen one? Let's see, come on. How about 2? 3? Amazing. How many people have been in Al-Anon, lost a husband, and went to AA to find another? It happens. It does. It happens. Now, who's that about? That's not about them. It's about us. Now, in Al-Anon, we say there are no musts. I'm going to be very bold and brash and suggest to you that for me, and maybe for you, but for me, there is one absolute in Al-Anon if I am going to get better. Because we come into Al-Anon because our tradition says the only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in someone else, not us. Our public information literature doesn't say, are you screwed up? Come to Al-Anon. It doesn't say that. It says, is alcohol a problem in your home? Damn right. And if you will tell me how to get rid of the alcohol, I will be okay. Not they will be okay. I will be okay. Let's take a look at the selfishness of the Al-Anon. We talk about the selfishness of the alcoholic. Really. Let's talk about us. Those of us who live behind this veil of caring for another person come to an Al-Anon meeting saying, tell me how to get them to stop drinking so that my life will be better. Ooh. That hurts sometimes. But isn't that what we do? We hide behind that veil of caring, but really all we care about is us. This is when the alcoholics get to go to their Al-Anon. Yeah, it's about us. And so we come to the Al-Anon meeting saying, tell me how to get him to stop so I can be okay. And we say, come on in, dear. And slowly but surely, we try to encourage you to say, look, we have to look at ourselves here. Yeah, I can look at myself, but I don't want it. I'm the good one. I'm the one that's kept this family together. Oh, right? Aren't I the martyr? Right? We all know that. Everyone comes in with our wrist glued to our forehead. We all do that, right? I'm the one that's held us together. And even our communities and families will often support that. Aren't you so great? How do you put up with that? You've got to be an angel for putting up with that. Yes, I am. Aren't I so wonderful and beautiful? I'm the glue that's keeping this family together. No matter what goes on, I'm here. I'll stick with them no matter what. We come in with that. Absolutely. We never abandoned. And we come to Elna and they say, look at you. What are you talking about? I'm the good guy. I'm the good guy. Really? Really. So if there's 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, like our tradition says, that's what we practice. We Al-Anon members practice the 12 steps of AA, ourself. This is what I had to do. I came in on the side that said, it's them. And somewhere along the way, and it took a long time for me, I was able to cross over a bridge to the side of God's grace that says, oh my God, it's me. It's my actions, it's my attitudes, it's my behaviors that are causing this havoc in my life. And when we can reach that point, we have available to us what I personally believe is the most powerful tool for recovery known. 12 precise, concrete, specific directions to help us come to find a power much greater than the power we've been turning over our life to, an alcoholic. Our Al-Anon book says it this way. I have 4 tiny little quotes. The longer I'm in Al-Anon, the more clearly I perceive that alcoholism is indeed a sickness, a compulsion and obsession. But haven't I, too, been afflicted with a sick compulsion? Wasn't I determined to save the alcoholic to the same degree as he was addicted to alcohol? May 4th, it says, many of my punishments are self-inflicted. In some way unfathomable to my human intelligence, my suffering could be the consequence of my own attitudes, actions, or behaviors. June 3rd, it says, if we really do want peace of mind, the first thing to realize is that it does not depend on conditions outside us, but those inside us. And on July 27th, it says, Al-Anon's prime purpose is to help us deal with the problems that alcoholism has aggravated. The sponsor says it like this. She said, adding an alcoholic to a person like me is like sprinkling Miracle-Gro on my defects. This book officially was published on April the 10th, 1939, the AA book. Safe to say it was being written late 1938, early 1939. And all those years ago, Bill Wilson knew this. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as it is for the husband. It is as good for the family as it is for the alcoholic. They knew that all the way back there. If you are in Al-Anon and you read the AA Big Book, you will find, especially in the last chapter, Vision for You, number of references to how the family can recover using the very same principles that the alcoholics do too. They knew that all that time ago. And somehow I think in Al-Anon we've lost that. I think that for me, I needed to come to that point where I realized. And that's what it hit me at the end of that third alcoholic. Oh my God, that is me. That is me. Because you see, I have a disease, ladies and gentlemen. I do not drink alcohol, but I have a disease called alcoholism. The family disease. Have you ever thought that when you have an alcoholic in your home and you take away the alcohol, you still live with alcoholism? Not the wet form, but we still live with alcoholism. And that is what we are here to recover from. The AA book says it's just that bottle's a symbol, the alcohol is a symptom. It's a hell of a symptom. And it's really good when that symptom goes away. Amen. Excellent. But there's a long way of recovery to go from there, as there is for those of us who have alcoholism, the family disease. So if it's a disease, it's got to have some symptoms for us. And what are our symptoms? One of them that we talk about in Al-Anon is, well, we have low sense of self-esteem, really. I never really had low sense of self-esteem. It was like kind of no sense of self-esteem. My goal was to kind of rise up to low. If I could rise up to low, I'd be happy. But you know, what I've realized in this program is that I'm not here to work on self-esteem. I've never kind of tackled that directly. I had someone say this one time, and it is so true. If you want self-esteem, do esteemable things. It sounds kind of cute, but it's the truth. And what are some of the esteemable things we are asked to do when we come here? We are asked to work the 12 steps of AA ourselves. What can be more esteemable than that? Taking a look at ourselves using these 12 steps to find a way to God. What can be more esteemable than finding that peace of a higher power and then being willing to answer the phone, to do a 12-step call, to go to the meeting to talk to somebody, to come to one of these deals? What can be more esteemable than taking the peace that we find and sharing it with another human being? That is how it has risen. Myself, as my low sense of self-esteem, it manifested itself in all kinds of odd ways. I hated to have my photograph taken. Couldn't stand my own body image. Anybody wanted to point a camera at me, I'd make a funny face, or I'd say, I don't like having my picture taken. I'd want to hide. I teach high school. And if you take a look at the early yearbooks of my career, take a look at the page where all the staff is, there's always a blank square, no picture available, with my name underneath it. Because I would not go down to get my photograph taken. I have 2 university degrees, and I was afraid to sit in front of a camera and have my picture taken for a yearbook. This is not about intelligence. It has nothing to do with that. It's operating on some totally different level. I hated to have my hair cut. Used to have some? Because when you sit in a chair, the guy behind you says, how do you want to look? My answer inside was, I want to disappear. But you go to buy pants. There's 3 mirrors. You can't get away from yourself. Ah! I hated to buy pants. It's just all these odd little ways that it kind of manifested itself. I hated to walk down like in a mall or a strip mall. You see, plate glass windows. I'd see my full body reflection, and I'd always look away. Could never kind of look at myself. That's how. Now, nobody ever told me that. Nobody ever taught me I was rotten, dumb, or ugly. Ever said that to me. But somewhere along the way, being involved in a disease, I got that message. Somehow that happened. Now, how it happened is irrelevant. The fact that by doing esteemable things that has risen is a great news. And I can tell you today that when it's time to take the yearbook pictures, I go down and say, hi. And I get my picture taken, and it's there, been there for a long time now, and I'm really grateful for that. The other thing in Al-Anon we say is that we're people pleasers. Really. I've never really wanted to please you in my life. Ever. The only thing I've ever wanted from you is approval. So if I can do something where you will say, hey, pretty good, Rick, for a brief moment in time, you become my higher power, and I can feel like that hole is filled up. So instead of being a people pleaser, what I say I am is an approval sucker. And I will do anything, anyhow, anyway, to whatever level I have to get your approval. And for a brief moment in time, I can go, I'm okay. But then, it goes away. Step 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. People in Al-Anon have known that for a long time. As I've always known that some higher power greater than me could do that. Money, position, another person, cute woman, on. Because for any moment in time, they give you that feeling for a while, and then it goes away. The best one was the alcoholic woman. That one lasted a good long time. But even that went away. But there are others, and that's really, here I go on, just tell you a few more of them as my time marches on here. Number one on my hit parade, really, of all the things that that have helped me kind of fill that little gap is this. It's that need to be needed. Everybody was looking for anybody to love me. I was always looking for somebody who needed me. I did not know that. That was not conscious thought. I didn't read that in the book anywhere. But as I reflect on my actions, that's exactly what I was doing. And as it turns out, I found myself, I was in university. I just finished my second year. I teach music. I was studying music at the time. And I had finished doing an audition to go to a school out in Western Canada in Banff. Got accepted to go. And the person who accepted me says, look, why don't you contact the other 4 people who are going to be playing in this quintet with you and arrange to have a rehearsal before you come out to the school, and you'll be a little farther ahead when you get and start the program. Makes great sense. So I phoned 3 of the other members, made arrangements for a rehearsal, and then I phoned her. And I want to tell you that the kind of attraction I have to alcoholics can go right through a phone line. I don't even have to see them to understand that there's something going on, there's some kind of energy. So I phoned this woman, and man, she was exciting. And it was supposed to be this 5-minute call to make an arrangement for rehearsal. It turned into an hour-long lust fest. And she had, you know, we just kind of talked about all kinds of things, and she had been places that I wanted to go and met people that I wanted to meet and played music with people I wanted to play music with and played the kind of music that I wanted to play. And she was exciting and alive and energetic and all those things. I didn't feel that I wasn't. It was kind of like, wow! So we hung up, and we started talking on the phone kind of regular, and I never set eyes on her. But I'm the kind of Al-Anon that likes to investigate. So I started asking around about her, and I found out some neat things. I found out that she was really quite cute. I said, hey, that's good. Found out that she was a fantastic musician. I said, hey, that's good too. And then they said, and she's really experienced. And I said, now that's really great. Because you see, I wasn't really experienced, at least not with other people. Had to do something in that closet. Guilty. Anyhow, one day I'm at work. I had this summer job working in the liquor store, if you can believe that. She phoned me up, and she was drunk on a Saturday afternoon. First sign. And she says, I had this boyfriend. He was supposed to come over. He didn't come over. I drank this bottle of wine. Do you want to come over? I'd been an Altine about 10 years at this time, and into Al-Anon, and a small little part of my head went, bad. Another whole part of my body went, yes! I can help you with that. I understand that. If you had been overeating or gambling or going, what is that about? But alcohol, there's something about that that I get. So I didn't go over that day, but boy, I sure wanted to. And this magic moment came when we were finally to meet and we were going to head off to the school, and I was sitting at the airport with my mom and dad, and in she came, and guys, she was bouncing. She had this little blue top on and this glistening black hair, and the energy was just sparking off of her, and I kind of watched her bounce down to us, and she stood right in front of me and my mom and dad, and she kind of bent right over, put down her suitcase with her trumpets in it, and it's beautiful. Hi! The mother went into mild cardiac arrest. My dad, the eyes popped right out of his head. And I'd been in Altine long enough to know I was about to have a spiritual experience. I said, Mom, Dad, see you later. I'm gone. So we got in the airplane, and I ordered a beer. And when Al-Anon says they order a beer, we mean one. She ordered one, and then two, then three, and she ended up with five of them on this trip out west. And if there's anything I say today that you can take to the bank, it's that she had five beers. Because I've never met an Al-Anon that can't count. Tell you the color of the label, the brand, how much it costs. We know, baby. Said to my sponsor one day, I said, I count everybody's drinks. Does it ever go away? She said, no. And it doesn't. It's just kind of one of those deals that I accept. So we got out to that school, and I discovered that it was really great doing things with someone else. Man, it's fabulous. And, we played music together. But there was something even better. There was something even better. Because after we'd play the music and after, we'd have that experience, we'd have therapy. And that was the best of all. Because she would tell me her problems, and I would tell her how to fix them. Yeah. And a couple of weeks into this, I used to call it a relationship. A friend at home, Mildred is her name. She calls it a parasitic entanglement. Heard another guy call it one time, it's like two ticks without a dog. So I'm into this thing. And she says these words to me a couple of weeks into it. She says, Rick, I've been seeing this therapist for an awful long time now, but I don't need to see that therapist anymore because now I have you. Take that in. Listen to that. If your approach to life is I'm a nothing, and someone says to you, I don't need him because now I have you, I'll tell you what that did for me. It filled me up the way I hear alcoholics talk about alcohol filling them up. It did it for me. And we were together out at that school for the 7 weeks that we were there, and I came home, and I started introducing her to people, and are they saying, wow, really nice? They're saying, Rick, what are you doing with this woman? Did I say, well, hey, we have a lot in common, we really had a great time out there, and I didn't say any of that. All I said was, deep down inside, there's a beautiful person, and I'm going to help bring her out. Oh, so noble, aren't I? Fell in love with the potential. It was like a 24-hour-a-day thing, So I hear alcoholics talk about, you get drunk, and then you get sober, and you get drunk, and you get sick. How stupid. Just find a female alcoholic. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You just never have to let it go. It's there all the time. And that's what I needed to fill up this hole that I had in me. The alcohol didn't do it, but a female alcoholic, like that, baby. did it. 4 years or so into this, I found out I was bored. Like a dog that catches a car, what do you do with it when you get it? Well, you keep it. And I found myself, after I finished university, I was sitting in front of a principal of a downtown school in Toronto, interviewing for a job as a teacher, and he said, you know, Rick, we have a lot of very needy students in this school. Oh, God. Brother, I am the man for you. He said, you know, people say these kids can't do a lot. Oh, really? Now, if there's anything an Al-Anon like me loves, it's a challenge. Now, did I go in there to prove to those kids that they could do things because I really cared about those kids? No. I did it because I wanted them to look at me and say, you did what no one else could do. And for a brief moment in time, I could suck that in and believe that I was okay. Because, you see, there is a God in this universe, and at that time, I was not accepting that God. At that time, I did not want to have anything to do with that God. That everything around me, everything that I chose, was my higher power. And if I could get this, I would be okay. And so I set out to prove that. 3 years later, these kids that couldn't play anything, we did a show, Fiddler on the Roof, the whole show. Played the book, the kids were singing up on the stage, the whole deal. And at the end of our final performance, the principal that hired me, called me up out of the pit where I was conducting the orchestra, and he brought me up onto the stage and hugged me in front of all these people, many more people than are even in this room today. And he pushed me back, but he kept his hands on my shoulders, and he had a microphone there, and he said, Rick, the very best decision I've ever made since I was principal of this school was to hire you. Yeah! That was a good one. Lasted like a day or two. But like anything that is of man, like anything that comes from another place other than the power, it goes away. It is merely an illusion. But that is the illusion that I was living in. But that's not it. There's many other things that I involved myself in that are symptoms of alcoholism, the family disease, as it manifested itself in this Al-Anon that you're looking at this afternoon. Another one of them was anger. I loved to be angry. It pushed you away, just like the sign did in my closet. Loved it. I loved this power surge that happened when I would scream and holler at you. I love the power surge of knowing that, you know, you could come in just so far, but if you come in any farther, you're dead. I loved it. That wasn't conscious. It was only upon reflection that I see I did all of that kind of stuff. Grew up in an angry home. Did I inherit that? I have no idea. All I know is that when I was angry, I used to stuff, and I'd stuff, and I'd stuff, and I'd stuff. So when I came back to Al-Anon in 1987, April the 10th, I married that trumpet player, by the way. She divorced me, the ingrate. Did she know what she had? Yes, she did. That's why she left. I came back to Al-Anon, and it was really a sick puppy in Al-Anon, because I'd just kind of forgotten to tell people that I'd left for 3 years. Because, you see, Al-Anon's going to have slips, too, and I am an Al-Anon slipper. I was in Al-Anon for 10 years, I was in Al-Anon for 5, and I left. So in alcoholic terms, I went out and I got drunk. I went out and I had an Al-Anon drunk. And when I came back, I really should have said I'm zero, but I didn't do that. The ego was too big. And so I was kind of pretending that I knew all this stuff. And you can still remember the words, right? This is a dangerous place. You know a few of the words, but you're really not getting any recovery. You kind of think you're getting better on fellowship, and that's what I was doing. I wasn't getting better. Fellowship recovery is an illusion. Nice to come here because we all enjoy one another. It's a nice, easy place to be. We kind of learn the words, and we think we're getting better. Well, maybe you are. I wasn't. I was getting sick, 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 and sicker. But I'm in my meeting, and I'm the GR, and I'm sitting at the back of the room. We used to sit kind of theater style in the meeting I attended, and I was speaking about step 12, speaking about this marvelous spiritual awakening and in soft, dulcet tones. And two people beside me, a man and a woman, started playing with each other's shoelaces while the great one was speaking. A rage came out of me in my Al-Anon meeting at these people, tore a strip off of them, and then went back to speaking in soft, dulcet tones about this marvelous spiritual awakening. You could hear like a collective gasp from everybody in the group going, the GR is killing somebody at the back of the room. There was definitely a time when they did not want what I had. And at the end of the meeting, nobody would talk to me. They basically shunned me, and that bothered me. And a few days later, someone had the courage to call and say, Rick, you got to do something about that. So I started taking a look in the ODEP book, and, you know, it's anger. You look up anger. It says, well, you know, if we find ourselves getting angry, we count to 10. I just get angrier. It gives me 10 seconds to really build it up. and let it out. And then that stuff started to work for me. And other things had been going on that I was kind of afraid to acknowledge. Like, for example, I'd be standing at this Al-Anon meeting listening to somebody talk, and they're sharing things that are going on with them. And, you know, kind of going, yes, trying to be kind and caring and considerate looking at them and nodding my head up and down. And inside I'm thinking, I'd like to smack you right in the mouth. I'd like to take that nose and put it right in your ear. And these thoughts would come into my mind. They would just pop in. And here I am with the GR. That started to frighten me. Thank God. If that's happening to you, be afraid. Seek some help if that's happening to you. Happy to tell you today that I haven't had those feelings for a long time. So if you'd like to come out and shake my hand, I promise I won't smack you in the mouth. But other things would go on. Like, I'm at home one day and I'm making a fried egg. So I was a bachelor. Bachelors have fried eggs for dinner. And so I put the egg in the pan and I broke the yolk. Oh. And so I reached into the pan and took that goopy egg, threw it against the wall, took the pan, went bang, 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 on the stove. And I look around and realize I'm the only one in the kitchen. I thought, there's something going on here. One time I was walking down the hall in a high school, and a kid who was kind of mentally challenged reached up and grabbed my tie. Before I could even think, I had grabbed his, lifted him up, and pressed him into a locker. Thought, this is not good. Let him down and walked away going, holy God, what's going on with me? Another time, I'm conducting the band in a situation like this. You know, a lot of people there, parents, right? I'm conducting the band. A kid sticks his face out in a curtain, looks at me and goes, closes the curtain. Now there's an audience full of parents in the gym. I stop the band. I put down my baton and I walk off. Go to the back of this, behind the curtain, grab him, threaten, like scare the crap out of him, come right back out, bow to the parents, and continue conducting the band. That's the kind of anger I'm talking about. To transfer into rage, you know, kind of my definition of rage is I want to rip the skin right off of your face. That's my definition of rage. But it really was scary. I got to really be honest with you about that. And so, keep it in mind, I did seek some outside help for that. And it was kind of what I was finding in Al-Anon that led me to that. And the spiritual growth in Al-Anon was what sustained me through it. And after that ended, my Al-Anon, I'm still here. Because this is an ongoing spiritual recovery. But at that stage of my life, I did need someone to help me with that. And what I discovered when that process was that what I am really is not, I'm really not an angry guy. I'm really not an enraged guy. What I am is a terrified guy. What I am is so full of fear of you. It's that keep out thing, like that closet sign. And that I could keep you out, the anger protected me from you coming in. But again, that was the thing that I wanted the most. And when I came to know and understand on a cellular level almost, that it was fear and terror that was bringing this on, these 12 steps really, really kicked in. Because these things deal with fear really, really well. There were times in my life around that time when all that was going on to me when I'd have thoughts pop into my head. I'd be driving to work and it would just go, flick the steering wheel, Rick, and it's over. I'd be standing on the sidewalk. Take one step, Rick. The bus will get you, and it's done. Because you see, rage and anger have two sides. Homicide, suicide. It's the same thing. In Al-Anon and in AA, we give the definition of insanity as being doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. It's an excellent definition. I'll offer you an additional one. When we are in a place where we truly believe that ending your life or mine is a legitimate solution to my problem, I am in a state of insanity. And we, for some reason, understand what that's like. This is the only place that I know where I can stand up and say I haven't had to plan any kind of death, yours or mine, since April 10th, 1987, and everybody laughs and claps. If I stood up in front of the parents of the students that I teach and said, hello, parents, I'm teaching your son this year. And guess what? For 19 years, I haven't had to plan any kind of murder, your, somebody else's or mine. My parents would not go, way to go, Mr. Jatuk, we're happy to know that. I'd be looking for another job. They just don't have a sense of humor, those parents. But we understand that particular insanity that tells us this is a way out. Amazing. There's other things that Al-Anons like me do. I love to be a victim. Now, was I a victim in an alcoholic environment? I'm really not sure. I don't believe for a second my father ever did any of that stuff on purpose, or anybody did that stuff on purpose. Disease was there, and disease did it. So am I a victim of a disease? No more so than an alcoholic is. But what I did was I chose to be a victim, because I love it. Because I'm always the hero of the story when I'm a victim. Think about that. When you're telling a story from a victim angle, who's the good guy? Moi. Who's the one that's always right? Moi. Who's the one that always gets the attention? Moi. Who's the one that always gets the sympathy? Moi. And if you're an attention seeker like me, what better way to get attention is there than to live your life from the perspective of a victim, even though you have never been one? And it took me a long time before somebody finally said, Rick, you know, it's kind of pathetic. You're 35 and you're still blaming everything in your life on them. And that really hit. There was kind of an opening. God's grace came in, and I finally heard that. What I really was just a whining victim. Whining, you know what the definition of whining is? My favorite line of all time. Whining is anger escaping through a very small hole. That was me, baby. And Al-Anons, I guess, become martyrs. You know, we do more than is humanly possible just so people will look at us and say, aren't they great? You know, what a martyr is, really, though, is just a victim with a mission. I'll show you. And on and on and on. We're obsessive controllers. We're this, we're that. Fill in the blanks for yourself. But if you're in Al-Anon, I encourage you to take a look at what it is that you do that you need to recover from. Why are you willing to sit here on a beautiful Saturday afternoon in this phenomenal location and listen to this blabbermouth from Toronto? Why are you doing it? Why are you willing to go to those meetings? Why are you willing to be involved in that service? Why do we do this over and over and over again? What are we looking for? What I'm looking for is health, growth, recovery. That's what I'm looking for, and that's why I come, because these are the things that I do apart and separate from any alcoholic in my life. Most of them have left or died. And without this program, I would be doing what I've been describing to you, only expanded upon. That my disease is not dependent upon the condition of any of the alcoholics in my life, because you see, it is mine. I am inflicted with it, and that is why we have the grace called the 12 steps of AA that can and will help us. I need to do that with a sponsor. I cannot do that by myself. The doctor will say if you are giving yourself your own diagnosis, you have an idiot for a doctor. If you're sponsoring yourself, you have an idiot for a sponsor. Me. I did that for way too long. The seminal moment in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous is not when Bill had that spiritual experience in that hospital. That was when he had his last drink. Great thing. But the seminal moment in the history of AA is Mother's Day of 1930. Actually, not Mother's Day, June 10th. But Mother's Day was the real day they met. Bob drank one more time, so that's why the anniversary is June 10th. But Mother's Day of 1935 is when Bill met Bob. And they discovered the power that we know that's happening in this very room now in Canandaigua. I know I do know how to say it. And here we are. And here we are all over the world. If you had a chance to be in Toronto in July, when the World Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous, accompanied with Al-Anon, sat together in a dome stadium, we realized that from that meeting in Akron, Ohio, two people met, and there we filled a baseball stadium with people that understand what it's like to go, yeah, I know that feeling. And thank God we have something that can help us. That is available to us. But I need to invite someone in. And it took me a long time to invite someone in. And finally, I met somebody who I wanted to. I had a sponsor. He left. I was without a sponsor. And if there's only any one thing that's worse than not having a sponsor, it's having had one and then having had one go. Because you know what it's like. His name was Bob, and I'd call him up every once in a while. I'd say, Bob, hey, can I come down to see you? Have you got any time? He said, Rick, for you, anytime. Listen to that. Rick, for you, anytime. And I'd pop down and would have a chat. He was great for me. He moved away and just kind of didn't work, and so I was without a sponsor. So I started reading her Al-Anon literature, and it said, if men sponsor men and women sponsor women. Well, if you look around Al-Anon and you're a guy, there's just not a lot of men around in Al-Anon, and that is just reality. But I took that to heart. I thought it was a rule instead of a suggestion, so I kind of made out this list of requirements for the sponsor that I needed to get, and I went looking around, and there wasn't anybody, because it was pretty rigid. So I started to pray about it, and I even started to utter it. Started to talk to people about it. This dear friend of mine, Mildred, that I have, I told her too. So time came about 12 years ago when we had a conference in Toronto and a speaker came, and I met with her on a Friday. And after she spoke, yeah, say hello. After she spoke on Saturday, she came to get me and she said, hey, let's go out and have some ice cream. So you're walking along in downtown in Toronto and she says these gorgeous, gorgeous words to me. She said, Rick, tell me about you. And I said, well, I tried to chop up my wife's head with an axe on a camping trip. She laughed. We bonded. She had just finished telling us a story about trying to drown her husband in a bathtub. I understood that. So what I realized that later was that I had forgotten to put on my list of requirements for a sponsor was potential murderer. So we kind of understood that particular level of insanity. And so a few days later, I found myself in a place, talking to this friend of mine, Mildred. She said, have you found a sponsor yet? I said, no. She said, I think you have. And so I prayed about that, and I wrote a letter. And so I wrote this woman a letter, and I said, I love meeting you. I really love what you've got. And I said, I'm sick to death of doing this alone. Alone. I had done this. And really, there's no such thing as doing it alone. If you're doing it alone, I'm not doing it. I'm just kind of doing fellowship. Coming to the meetings, I'm reading the stuff, but I'm doing it alone as I'm not doing it. I'm kind of hanging out, fooling myself that I'm getting better. But the spiritual awakening doesn't come from going to meetings. It doesn't say, go to the meetings and have a spiritual awakening. Come to the meetings, I'll find people that are practicing a program, and that fellowship will support me as I walk through a program myself. That's what this fellowship does. That's why I need this fellowship so much. Anyway, I sent her this letter saying, I love what you have, and I said, if you will be my sponsor, I will do absolutely anything you ask me to do. That's how I asked her to be my sponsor. And I sent this letter away, and a number of days later, I got a package in the mail. I said, well, she talks a lot, maybe she writes a lot, too. She made me a really long forget it, pal, or I'm in. And so I opened this up, and there was a beautiful little letter there from her. She said, I really enjoyed meeting you, and I got your request for sponsorship. She said, I've been praying about that. And very importantly, she said to me, I spoke to my husband about that. Because you see, this is an intimate relationship between a sponsor and a sponsee, or a pigeon, as she calls me. And she said, I talked to him, and he said, well, is it a reasonable Al-Anon request? She said, well, yes, it is. So he said, what's the problem? And she told me that, and that made me feel so good and comfortable, because he has become a super important person in my life as well. So she said, he said it's a reasonable Al-Anon request. I said, yes. So she said, welcome to the family. Listen to that, eh? Now, put this in perspective. I'd started this deal when I was 11 years old. I'd spent 10 years in Alteen and never really asked anybody to be my sponsor. Used a couple of guys to do a few things, but never made the commitment. See, and that's what it's about for me today. When you don't ask somebody, there's no commitment. It's kind of using somebody. I've done that my whole life. Hung around in Al-Anon for those 5 years, didn't ask or really use anybody. Left. Came back, was still kind of hanging around, doing it myself. By definition, not doing it. Met this guy, Bob, started to do it, he left, was not doing it again. And somebody says to me, welcome to the family. I cried. At last, God's grace had come to a point. I had reached that point of desperation that said, I gotta do something. Something has to happen here. And I finally took the sign down that said, keep out, and asked her if she would come in. And she did, and God came in with her. There's a nice thing, last nice thing she said to me for a year. She said, you are one sick puppy. She had all kinds of wacky nicknames for me, one of the Ricky Doodah, asshole, dummy, things like that in the beginning. She said, I don't care what you've done, where you've been, this is what you will do. Yes. Finally, some direction. And the direction had always been there. I had just never allowed myself to involve myself in it. finally it was there. So she said, this is what I want you to do. I want you to buy every single book that Al-Anon has. I want you to buy the AA Big Book, and I want you to buy the AA 12 and 12. Smart Mouth says, I'm in Al-Anon. We don't use the AA Big Book. Listen, dummy. How are you going to practice the 12 steps of AA yourself unless you use the book called AA? A. I said, okay. And from that moment to this, I am a Big Book Al-Anon. Because that is the foundation text for the program that my fellowship tells me to practice. My fellowship says in the traditions for the fellowship that I belong to that we practice the 12 steps of AA ourself. That's exactly what the tradition says. And how on earth am I going to do that unless I am willing to include in my recovery the foundation text for the program? And the program is not the traditions, not the concepts, not these conferences, not my meetings. That's the fellowship. Have to have the fellowship. Love it. The program is 1 to 12. That's the program. And the foundation text is the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. So I include that in my reading. And she said, I don't want you to read the book from cover to cover, each Al-Anon book. She said, I want you to read just about one topic in each book. So we're doing step one. So she said, you pick up one book and read everything about step one in it and shut the book. Wow. Don't read the book like this. Read a list of topics like this, all about step one. And I started to get the thread of what powerlessness for the family member is through the shared writings of our fellowship, because that's where our literature comes from. Fantastic. We write our experience and you share it with me through those words. And I started to get the idea. Fantastic stuff. When I read a book from front to back, see, my mind works kind of like a fly, housefly flies around a house. Start in one place and it just kind of goes all over. Here's an example. I'll set out, it's a Saturday afternoon, let's say, and I bring a vacuum into my front room. The intent to vacuum the carpet. There's the vacuum. I see a glass on the coffee table. I take the glass and I bring it into the kitchen. There's a few more glasses in there. Hey, I'll put them in the dishwasher. While I'm at it, I may as well clean up the counter. Well, gee whiz, the tea towels are kind of dirty. Let's bring them down into the laundry room. Go down to the laundry room, put the towels in. I say, well, gee, there's towels in the bathroom. I'll go into the bathroom, clean up the bathroom a little bit, bring the towels in, put them into the washing machine, look up in the laundry room and say, there's the car brush. Gee, I need to wash my car. So 15 minutes after going into the front room to vacuum my carpet, I'm outside washing my car, and a thought comes, are you going to vacuum the carpet? And that's what happens. And I read the book from front to back. It's kind of one topic, one topic, one topic. And my mind goes, aah! But doing it this way, I started to get the thread of powerlessness and unmanageability. She gave me a dozen questions to answer. I answered those questions. We talked about it. And then she said this. Listen to this. She said, congratulations, Rick. You've done step one to the best of your ability today. Move on. Oh, listen to that. Move on. I'm not talking about activity. I'm talking about action. And action takes me from point A to B. Activity keeps me at A. Fellowship activity with no program activity is like a hamster in a wheel for me. Run, 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 run. At the end of the day, I'm in the same spot. Program activity takes me from A to B. I did that with two. I did it with three. I did the inventory in four. I got in an airplane and flew down to Sear. She sat for 2 days and listened to my fifth. Went out in the backyard and burnt it. Beautiful. Said a prayer with each page as we burn it. Came back into her kitchen. I sat down and I said this to her. I said, I have told you everything. There's not a single thing that I am consciously aware of that I have left out of this. And listen to what she said to me. She said, Rick, I love you more because I know you better. I love you more because I know you better. My deepest fear was that if you knew me, you would loathe me. You would banish me from your very presence. All my life I had wanted to get there, and I had been walking that way. I could never get there, and it was frustrating. And what these steps do is they take us and under the guidance of another person, sharing their experience, not teaching us, sharing their experience of what they did using these 12 steps. The steps grab us, and they take us, and they point us in the direction that says, Rick, go this way. That's what they do. And what this way brings us to is what I believe is the single greatest promise we have, the spiritual awakening. That there is a God that I understood when I got to 12 that I had no idea of in step one. If the God instead, if I had limited myself to the God of my understanding early on, I would have ripped myself off. because there is a God of such a broad, deep understanding that I have now that I had no idea. He was a control kind of God before. Now can open me up, and there is a God that can do so much and has done so much in my life. And I'm bold enough to call God by his name, God. And this would be a great point to take a break and then come back and do a 12-step talk. I'm not going to do that. Thank God. I am in Al-Anon and on and on and on. I have a few minutes left before the tape runs out, so I'll end. So I'll just tell you a couple of quick stories. I've had a few challenges in my life with relationships. Now, there's no problem. I mean, the promise is not you'll have a better relationship, but I become a better person, and so my relationships start to improve. At the end of the third alcoholic, my sponsor says to me, "You might want to take a bit of a break." I said, "Good idea." She said, "Let's try 4 months." So I tried 4 months, and the 4 months was up on a New Year's Eve, and I was down visiting her on a New Year's Eve, and I said, "Well, hey, my 4 months is up tonight, and I'm here, I'm thinking a Playboy bunny's going to come running in at midnight going, here, let's go, baby." Because when a sponsor tells you, "I think you should take 4 months off," that's sponsor talk for celibacy, gentlemen. That's what that means. She said, "I think you need to discover that you can have friendships with women that are not sexual." I didn't know that. Truth. I didn't know that. I'm being honest with you here. She said, "You need to find out, Rick, that you can be okay by yourself. You don't have to have someone to look after you." Really? And I needed some time away to discover that. So at the end of the 4 months, I said, "You know, hey, it's up tonight." She says, "Well, I'm thinking about extending that." I said, "I knew you were going to do it." She said, "What do you think?" I said, "I think you're right." A year came and went, and the Playboy bunny didn't arrive, and 2 years came and went, 3 years came and went, and I said to her, "You know, hey, I have needs." She said, "God hasn't taken you this far to let you down." 4 years came and went, and I said, "Hey, I'm going for the record." And a beautiful thing happened. I was at an event like this, sitting in the back row, and somebody left who was sitting beside me, and someone came down to sit beside me. I looked over, and I thought, the drought might be over. Reached out and shook her hand, and I kind of ran out of time, so I won't get into the whole story. And today we are 6 months into it is not a parasitic entanglement, and it is not two ticks without a dog. Last weekend, her and I were at a conference in Erie, Pennsylvania, with one of the longest, the person I know longest in my whole life. I've known him for 40 years. And he tapped my shoulder, and he says, "You know what Al-Anon's done for you? It's fixed your picker." What a fantastic compliment, because my picker was broken. He said, "It's fixed your picker." And you know what? It has. My sponsors met her. It's an amazing thing. Now, I used to say her clothes are in her closet and my clothes are in mine. The way it is today is more mine are in hers and more hers are in mine. And so we're kind of moving in a pretty neat direction, but we certainly have not rushed into this 6 years later. And we're letting the relationship drive what goes on instead of some fabricated thing of driving the relationship. The relationship is growing. And that patience came to me from being in here. And I'll end with one story that my sponsor told me to end with every single time I share. It's a story about the relationship I have with my father, the alcoholic, the prime and major alcoholic in my life. Whenever I was with my dad, I would always kind of relate to him as a boy, and it bothered me. And as I was moving along in my recovery, I wanted to have a relationship with this man. So my sponsor suggested, "Well, why don't you start spending some time with him, talk to him equally, instead of always going there as the child?" I said, "Okay, I can start taking those actions." And so we decided we'd start to do a few things together. My dad loves the outdoors, as do I, and so I said, "Hey, Dad, why don't we take a canoe trip? One day we'll kind of go somewhere." And so we did that. We had this lovely, you know, kind of one day and overnight and then the next day. And I loved it, sitting around the campfire with my dad. He was sober at the time, and it was really a great thing. And so we tried another one. You know, we went for a couple of days, two overnights, 3 days. But like any of us, or I don't know you guys, but I'm an extremist, so if one is good, two is better, 50 is better. Let's just go all the way. So we said, let's take a really big one. So we decided to take a canoe trip up in the Northwest Territories. So far up that the sun didn't set. 14-day trip down this raging whitewater river. It took 4 airplanes to get there. They drop you, like they land the last plane on a gravel bar beside the river, drop all your stuff off and take off and say 14 days down. So there we are. With my dad and I and a guide and one other person, 2 canoes, 4 people. So it was pretty cool for a while. So we got onto the river the next day, and the guide started teaching us one of the very important things on a whitewater river is that you need to stop the canoe, and that you need to do certain things to do that. It's called an eddy turn. So you need to make certain movements. You flip the canoe around, and the canoe kind of floats into the shore. And so the first day, the guy taught us how to do this, and my dad's in the back. I'm in the front, the weenie position, power position in the back. And the he's barking the instructions at me. And so day one, I said, hey, this is great. We got it. Day two, he's still telling me the instructions. I'm thinking, yeah, I'm really getting this. Day three, I'm thinking, I know how to do this. Day four, he's telling me the instructions. I'm thinking, I know how to do this now. Day five, day six, and am I saying I know how to do it? No. I'm stuffing it down. So by day seven and eight, he tells me, and finally it cracks. And he tells me the last time, it tells me, I scream at the top of my lungs, I know how to make a goddamn eddy turn. And turn around and look at him, and at that very moment in time, he felt it to be the most appropriate thing to say to me was, I love you. What? That was it. It was over for me. The octopus went on my face. I couldn't see a thing, and the rest of the trip was a nightmare. I was in the tent with this guy. I was in the canoe with this guy. I was sitting around the campfire with this guy. I wanted to kill this guy. We were out there to bond, and I wanted to murder him. I get home from the trip. I call my sponsor. She says, how was the trip? Good sponsors will ask you good questions and then hover like a buzzard. I said, you want to hear about the trip? And I go into this litany of all the bad things. I stop to take a breath, and she says, tell me something good. Not a thing. She says, you mean to tell me you were out there for 14 days in this gorgeous place, and there's not one good thing? Yes. She said, assignment, you will write for me next week, this week to come, a list of good things. I said, okay, I can do that. Took me a whole week. I found seven things, wrote them down on a list, called her on my Monday night call-in, and said, hey, I got them. Read them off to her. She said, excellent. Now you will write him a letter. Oh, God. She said, you will write a love letter to your dad, and you will say these things to him in the letter. And she said, remember, this is a love letter. This is not a I'm going to get you letter. This is not this is what you did letter. This is an amend. This is an amend love letter. So I wrote it, and I said, dear Dad, I really want to thank you for the trip down the Nahanni. I want to thank you for helping me out a bit with the cost. It was expensive, and I needed some help. I really appreciate that, Dad. I said, Dad, I want to tell you how proud I was of you, that you knew more about the geography, the plant life, the animal life, than the guide. He was teaching the guide things. I said, Dad, I hope when I'm your age, I will have the physical strength to take a trip like this. He was in his mid-60s. And I said, Dad, I want to thank you for leading me down the mountain. Because we had this experience on the trip where you stop and you go up and you take a hike up a mountain. Now, I'm afraid of heights. I just went off and did this hike up the mountain. We get up halfway. Everybody stops and is looking around thinking, wow, this is great. I'm looking around thinking, too high, too far. So the time comes to proceed up to the mountain. And the magic moment happened. The guy said, hey, we're going up. I said, no, I think I'm going to go down. And my dad looked at them, and he looked at me, and he said, I'm going to go down with Rick. And my adult father led his adult son down the mountain. He took a few steps. He said, Rick, come down this way. Took a few more. He said, Rick, come down this way. And we did that all the way down. And in my blindness, I didn't see that. So I wrote that in the letter. I put it in an envelope, mailed it. And 3 days later, he called me, and he had been crying. He said, son, I got your letter. He said, Rick, it is the most beautiful thing I've ever received in my life. He said, I will value that experience that we had together forever. He said, son, it just meant more to me than words can tell you. He said, I love you deeply. And I said, Dad, I love you deeply, too. And it was such an incredibly powerful moment of healing that came from what goes on in here. Today, the letter is in the photograph album that he keeps underneath his coffee table. Everybody who comes in hasn't seen the photograph album. He shows them the photograph album and lets them read my letter. It's his letter. He can do with it what he wants. My dad had been sober for about 20 years, 22, 23, I can't even remember now, and drank again and still drinks to this day. And I needed to remember and needed to be reminded that alcoholism is a disease. And he has it, and he is not a disgrace. And my father is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. And that it is my job to show up and be the very best son I can be to my father, a father I do love. And remember that he is an intelligent, caring, loving, humorous man that has a disease. And that disease does not color all that other stuff. Sometimes it gets in the way. It does not take all that other stuff away. It is there, along with the disease. And I choose to be the very best son and attach myself to him in the very best way that I can. And I am so grateful for that. There's a picture that stands on an altar in a side chapel of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, England. It's a picture of a traditional robed figure standing with his right hand knocking on a door and the left hand is holding a lantern. The top of the picture says, "The light of the world." Underneath the picture, it's scripted, says this, "Behold." I can't believe I forgot that one. "Behold, I stand here and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and have supper with him and he with me." And as we all know, the doorknob is on the inside, that God will never barge in. But when we are willing to take the actions called the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I begin to open that door, and that God can, will, and does come in. My sponsor said to me when she started sponsoring me, she said, "Rick, you cannot think your way into right action. You must act your way into right thinking, and the actions are called the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous." Thank you for inviting me here today.